Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to Moms Fighting Autism and our second annual Autism Conference. We're so happy that you've joined us. The topic I'm going to be moderating today is customized support, designing supports that work one person at a time with Beth Gallagher.
Hello.
I'm your moderator. Yes, hi, Beth. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis. There's two ways to listen to tonight's or to today's webinar, depending on where you are in the world. You can log into momsfightingautism.com, and the webinar is completely free. Once you're registered, you'll see a blue box in the upper left-hand corner of the screen. There you can click Listen In and hear the discussion via the Internet, and you can also click Ask a Question if you'd like to submit a question for our speaker. You can also listen by phone by calling 949-333-4806 and enter conference ID 168-978-pound. All callers are immediately muted, so don't worry about us hearing you. We won't be able to hear you. Later in our webinar, I'll let you know how you can raise your hand to ask a question of our presenter. We try to get to as many of the questions and the common themes as we can in the time we have allotted. If afterwards you have a question, Beth will be sharing her contact information with you, so you'll be able to ask her a question then. When the slideshow begins, Internet users can go to their blue box and click Slides to view the slideshow. It takes about 16 seconds to connect, so be patient. They will connect. And once the slides are up, you can synchronize the slides with either your phone or with the webcast audio by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. Be sure to mute your computer if you're listening via phone so you don't get an echo. Okay, so I will go ahead and tell you about Beth. Beth is the founder, owner, and executive director of LifeWorks. LifeWorks was founded in 2004 after Beth moved to San Diego from Chico, California. Her work with people with developmental disabilities began just 2 weeks after graduating from California State University, Chico, in 1986 with degrees in child development and psychology. While over two decades her emphasis has been on creating personalized services, she began her career operating group homes for persons with behavioral support needs and or medical concerns. The vast majority of her career has been focused on creating unique support situations for individuals with severe reputations. Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Beth?
Well, thank you for having me today. I really appreciate the opportunity. Aside from my career, which spans about 25 years or so, I'm also a mother of two adopted children, and my youngest daughter is not neurotypical, so she has some movement difference issues that we're working with. And so I'm coming at this presentation more as a professional, but I'm also a mom. So I have spent most of my career working with people that have been labeled and kind of marginalized from the service system because typically of behavior challenges or medical issues that preclude them from getting supports from typically driven agencies. So early on, I figured out that people that had differences that other people saw as challenging or not within their service code, they needed supports that were customized. And so for at least the last 20, 21 years or so, I've been focusing on figuring out how to do that and how to do that within the service system that exists in California. I've spent all of my career in California, so done a lot of consulting for other places, other states, and agencies and stuff like that, but I've been only in California, so most of my experience comes from that. What I know as a person working with person-centered planning and customizing supports is that for some reason, even though to me it makes 100% sense, it's not generally absorbed by other agencies, and it mystifies me. And as a mom, it mystifies me even more that people don't tend to look at supporting people as needing to be individualized and customized only for that person, that especially when you're working with people with different challenges, movement differences, autism, whatever it is, that the supports need to be only for that person and kind of built from the ground up. And so that's always been kind of a big ponderance for me. And so I've been trying to figure out why that is. One of the things that I know for sure about creating supports for people with autism that actually work and are successful is that they have to be customized one person at a time. Person-centered planning and all the tools that come along with that is the way that I go about doing customized work. I've learned from a vast array of people who have been doing person-centered planning, whether it be tools like MAPS and PATH, which I learned from Jack Pierpoint and Marcia Forrest from the Toronto area, or MAPS, doing essential lifestyle planning, which I've learned from Michael Small and the learning community. There's dozens of different tools that can be used in the classroom, in the home, in the residential setting, in the workplace, whatever it is. I think that the thing that drives people, there's many things that drive people away, and my question is, why are people not doing it? What I know for sure about person-centered planning is that there's innate or intense connecting with the person with the disability when you do person-centered planning. And I mean real person-centered planning, not just calling it person-centered planning. It really needs to come from the heart. It needs to come from creating a support system around that person, not just writing a plan in first-person format. That doesn't make it person-centered. Person-centered means that you're collaborating with the person, you're joining with that person, you're partnering with that person to make sure that services are about him or her. It's about intense listening, and what I mean by that is that people are listening with their whole body. They're not just listening with their ears. They're listening with their eyes. They're listening with their body. They're listening with being with that person. They're listening about everything that person does, and it's more intense than just listening with your ears. It's being able to celebrate the things that person has accomplished, being able to acknowledge that person is a gift and that they have gifts that they can give to the community, that they are people that have things that they would like to brag about if they have the opportunity and probably haven't been given that opportunity. It's about thinking outside of the box. And so if the plan is being derived from something that's already set up and then you're trying to fit the person into the plan, that generally is not going to work. So it needs to be start from scratch. You need to start with nothing and build the plan around that individual person. Therefore, any plan that you come up with is going to be completely unique. It's not going to be like any other plan. Joey's plan is going to be completely different than Betsy's plan, completely different than Jonathan's plan. They're all going to be different. If they're the same, then you know that you probably haven't done true person-centered planning. It's about figuring out how to dream with that person. In my experience, most parents and most individuals with developmental disabilities have not been expected to dream. In fact, it's been exactly the opposite. So sometimes it's actually learning how to dream all over again, figuring out how to allow that person to dream without squashing those dreams, making sure that if the dream is put out there, that anything that needs to happen in order for that dream to come true actually is done. So it's about problem solving and committing to that person every single time. My slides, when I condensed them for this for this format, got a little bit screwed up, so sorry about that. So there are so many benefits of doing person-centered planning that kind of demystify why people aren't doing them. Oftentimes, people are not doing person-centered planning because of not enough time, not enough money, that they feel it's not necessary or whatever. What I know as a person that runs an agency supporting people with autism and other disabilities is that as an employer, I know that I want the problems to be solved before they ever happen. I want to kind of head it off at the pass. If I do true person-centered planning and really listen to people, in particular listen to the person with a disability, but also listening to the parents, listening to the people that really know that person, I'm going to avoid all the pitfalls that would have happened had I not been listening or had I just put a plan into place and not considered what those people had to say. Oftentimes, what I hear from parents when we do person-centered planning with their child is that it's the first time that they felt like they were actually true stakeholders in what's happening with that person. They're given the opportunity to really collaborate with an agency, with a school district or whatever it is, and really be true partners. So they're working together. They're aligning their belief system instead of working against people. You can't do true person-centered planning and not collaborate. They're not compatible. Excuse me. So if you are truly doing person-centered planning, you know that everybody's going to be on the same page. It's not possible not to. The framework is set up right from the beginning in order to support the staff, in order to support the child, in order to support the family. In the person-centered planning, it's designed that way from the very beginning. So it provides a framework from which everything else is going to take place. Excuse me. Some of the reasons why person-centered planning isn't being used, it takes too much time. This is what I hear from a lot of people. It takes too much time. We don't have the budget for that. We can't allow our teachers to be out of the classroom for an hour to do a plan about Johnny. There's just no time for it. If every school district or every agency or every entity that's supporting people understood that the time that you invest in that child or that person that you're supporting is an investment in the future. It's an investment in making sure that problems don't happen in the first place. So, I'm sorry. If you take the time up front, you're going to save money in the long run. I've actually done studies of this in my agency. Oh my God, I'm having a cough attack. I've actually done studies of this in my agency on payroll, and I know for a fact that you will save money if you do this sort of planning with people up front. So that should never be an excuse, and it should never be an excuse that a person or a parent or an advocate would ever put up with. I'm sure you guys have heard of, the person doesn't communicate traditionally, so therefore he couldn't possibly plan for himself. And what that means basically is that it's our role to figure out what the communication style is. Stopping at the idea that that person doesn't communicate is completely unacceptable. So person-centered planning can be done with the person who uses the most non-traditional form of communication. Not using traditional language or not being able to use facilitated communication fluently or things like that is not an excuse for not doing planning around that person. Another excuse is we just don't have time. We just need to get the annual done. We don't have time for that sort of planning. That's like saying, I need to get my job done. That person's life doesn't really matter to me. We need to consider that the person with the disability is living their life, and we're just doing our job. So that's not really fair. That's not really fair to say that we don't have time for it, or we just need to get the annual done. Another excuse that happens is they say, well, the person's doing really well, so we don't really need to plan right now. It's like saying that I'm doing really well right now. I don't plan on having a future because right now, in April of 2011, I'm doing really well. So therefore, August of 2019 isn't actually something that I need to worry about because right now I'm doing really good. that doesn't really make sense when we think of it, about it, how it pertains to our lives. Dead and happy are incompatible, but alive and miserable are unacceptable. So we need to consider that a person-centered plan, a plan written about somebody, needs to be something that's alive and actually happening. So when you allow somebody to dream and create a plan for their future, the job of the person supporting that person is to make sure that that comes true. Don't ask somebody to dream and then don't have any expectation that that dream is going to be worked on or moved towards. An example of a path, this is an example of my agency's path that was done about 5 years ago. This is a path is a person-centered plan that is done graphically, and it's something that was derived out of the business community probably 20, 25 years ago, where people do backwards planning. So on the far right-hand side is the actual dream of the future, and all the way through the document from the far left-hand side through the circle part is the action plan that's going to take place in order to make somebody's dream come true. So this was like I said, this was done for an agency. This was done for my company back when we were fledgling and kind of barely keeping ourselves together. So this is more business planning, but these are done for individuals. They're done for agencies. They're done for families. I do them for families all the time. It's an awesome tool to use to help somebody really visualize what their future is going to look like. You walk away at the end of the session with an action plan labeling who's going to do what and in what time frame you're going to be getting that done in. This is an example of a path for an individual that I support who does some public speaking with me sometimes to present her path to people and show them what it's done for her. But I use Tammy's path to describe. Tammy's somebody who I know really, really well. I've known her for years. I thought that I had already had a preconceived idea of what her future plans were for her. And I almost tried to talk her out of doing a path because I thought I already knew what she wanted to do. When we started doing the path, she invited probably 15, 17 people, something like that. We started going on the path, and I found out that her future plan was actually completely different than anything I had ever thought that she wanted to do. So she's actually planning on purchasing a house. She's planning on going to Japan to learn how to make sushi. She's planning on doing some public speaking, which all of this path was done about a little over a year ago, and almost everything on it, with the exception of finalizing the purchase of her house, she's actually looking for a house right now, and also the trip to Japan hasn't happened yet, but it's happening in 2013. All of that stuff has come true, and she's made it all happen. None of these things, with the exception of the bowling ball, were things that I thought that she was going to put on her path. Everything came out. It's like giving the person the opportunity to visualize what their future is going to look like, giving them an opportunity to be heard, completely heard by people that mean something to them, you never know what's going to happen. So when people say that they know the person really well or that they already know what their dream is, it's not actually the case. You never know what's going to happen. So it's really important that we allow for opportunities for people to be heard in a way that really makes sense to them. this is another path for a couple that I support. This is a wedding path for a couple that was interested in getting married. And so this is a way that they used for planning their wedding and making sure that their future looked exactly like what they wanted. So a futures plan can be as big as what do you want your life to look like in 10 years to I'm going to plan my wedding and this is what I want it to look like. So a path is would be a tool that you would use when your gut is telling you, don't just stand there, do something. We have a future to plant here. Don't just stand around waiting for it to happen. If you want something to happen, put it out there. Once you put your future out there and your dreams, then it's more likely to come true because it's out there, people know about it, you've committed to it. You've put it into words. In most cases, you put it into pictures, and it makes things more vivid. So when your gut is telling you, don't just stand there, do something. A path would be a good thing to do. Another type of tool is called a map. And some of you, maps are used more predominantly in the school systems. They were designed to support people, students in the school systems originally. They're used for a lot of different purposes now, but this is kind of the outline of a map. And basically the difference between the map and the path is that this starts off more with the history of the person and things that have happened in the past that have brought that person to this place. Could be a health history or a schooling history or whatever it is. It focuses more on what the person's dream is, but also, in contrast, what is the person's nightmare? And with that said, the action plan at the end of it addresses what you're going to do to make the dream come true, in addition to what you're going to do to prevent the nightmare from happening, which is oftentimes, if somebody, let's say somebody is institutionalized and they've now moved into the community, their nightmare probably is that they would go back to the institution. So what steps are you going to take? What action plan are you going to commit to make sure that that institutionalization does not happen again? In the mapping, you're going to talk about dreams, nightmares, who that person is, what that person's gifts and talents are, and what that person needs in order to make the dream a reality. So a map would be when your gut is telling you, don't just do something, stand there, which is in contrast with don't just stand there, do something. So a map is more like you're going to focus on where that person is now. It's not completely about 5 years in the future, 3 years in the future, or something like that. It's more about recognizing where that person's been and where that person is now. Now, a different plan that I use a lot when I'm just trying to gather the best information on people, when I want to just slow down and get to know who that person is, as a provider, I'm making a commitment to partner with families around their son or daughter. I'm making a commitment to partner with that person with a disability, and I'm walking into the situation being the person who knows the very least about him or her. So I need to be prepared to say, you know what, I don't know you very well, and I want to figure out what is it that I need to know about you and who can help me get that information so that I don't recreate the wheel. I don't want to spin my wheels recreating service plans that are going to fail you because that information has already been designed. We already know, in most cases, what has worked and what has not worked. So I'm going to gather the people together who know that person best in one place, hopefully. It might be parents, it might be siblings, it might be teachers, it might be job coaches, it might be neighbors, pastors, who knows? It could be the guy at the 7-Eleven who knows him really well, I don't know. But that person generally will make that list, the invitation list. I am going to clearly announce to that group of people that I am the rookie in that situation and I'm vulnerable. I don't know anything about him or her, or I know very little. It's really helpful when somebody is able to say, although I might be recognized as the professional in the setting, I'm not the expert. So I think one of the reasons why planning doesn't take place oftentimes between schools and families or residential settings and families or day programs and families is because the professional, the quote-unquote professional in the situation, has a hard time saying, I don't know what to do. There's nothing more valuable than that. I don't know what to do. I need your help. I need to partner with you. I need you to tell me what works and what doesn't work, and we'll create something together. And maybe what's worked in the past hasn't been super successful, but if you don't recognize those things, you're going to fall into that pitfall again and again and again. So the other thing that needs to happen during these planning is creating ground rules, establishing procedures for gathering the information from people, and be flexible. You never know what could happen. The main person you want to gather information from is the person at the center of the plan. Now, even if that person doesn't use traditional means of communicating, they're going to have ways of telling you what's going on. So preparing that person ahead of time for what the essential lifestyle plan is about, you know, letting him or her know what's going to take place, letting him or her know also that it could be a little bit vulnerable, that we're going to talk about things that may or may not be necessarily pleasant, but allowing that person to participate in whatever way he or she can. Probably one of the best learnings around essential lifestyle planning and creating customized supports is that it's not my job to figure out what the answer is. My job is to figure out what the next best question is, because the planning never stops. If I am having a lot of success with somebody and they're doing fantastic, it doesn't mean the planning stops. It means that there's another next best question about what comes around the bend. What's the next thing that's going to happen for that person? So I don't want to come up with the answers. Answers are great. Don't get me wrong. I like being successful with people, but it's not about creating the answer. It's not about finding the final outcome. It's about really figuring out what is that next best question. And some examples would be, oftentimes I see plans. I get brought in to do planning for people a lot. And I'll see things like these examples that I have on here. So which one of these is more helpful? Justin does not have any friends. Or Justin has difficulty forming relationships in the traditional manner. Because Justin uses assisted typing for his communication, he needs support to build bridges with people initially. He also uses Facebook and email to increase opportunities for lengthy and more challenging conversations. Now, which one of those is more helpful as a teacher, as a job coach, as a support provider, as a communication aid, as a whatever it is that you are? There's two sentences there, or two comments about Justin. They both may be true, but the next best question about Justin was, why doesn't he have any friends, and how can I make that better? So just stopping at the fact that Justin doesn't have any friends is not helpful. Justin cannot brush his teeth. Now, this may or may not be true, but what we know about Justin is Justin cannot brush his teeth on his own. He needs total assistance with this task, which may look like hand over hand or even at times just doing it for him. He may need to move around during this process and may appear to be resistive, but is easily redirected if the support person allows him time to finish and is not pushy. He needs time and space. Give this task some time to finish successfully. Don't rush. It won't work. So as a person that provides personal care to Justin, both of these sentences are true, but one of them is a lot more helpful. So again, what is the next best question I need to ask to be successful with him? Justin is hyper, or Justin's team must be made up of very active people. Couch potatoes will not do. He needs to be able to be on the go most of the time, and being held back by a more sedentary team member is unacceptable. So again, if I'm going into this situation and all I know is Justin is hyper, that might lead a teacher or a care provider or a job coach to just spin their wheels trying to figure out how to keep Justin calmed down, how to contain him. But the reality is Justin's hyper. He's got a lot of energy. Do something about it. Don't require him to sit in a situation where he's going to need to be contained. You know, give him access to places where he doesn't need to be contained, and have people with him that aren't going to require that of him. Couch for Justin is actually an individual that we support, and Justin's entire team, initial team anyway, was formulated by the university. I live in San Diego, and so San Diego State and MiraCosta College and a couple of other colleges have track teams. And so Justin's entire team was sought out from the track team and the Sierra Club and those kind of people. So expecting Justin to sit and maintain wasn't a possibility. We decided to figure out how to allow Justin to be who he is, and that's one of the adaptations that we did for him. I need to change slideshows here. I hope I'm doing this right. Yes. Nancy, do you know how do I get to the next?
Go out of slides, go over to your left, and click on, let's try my events.
My events.
And go back in.
Okay, and
control panel.
Oh.
Click slides again.
Right.
And it should give you a list of options. I did the first time.
Okay, it's still got the first set of slides.
I'm going to take control of it for a second.
Okay.
Okay, when you get to that screen, let's see, my slides. Sorry, folks, while we figure this out, we have our presentation cut into two different sections because it was too long, so we're trying to access the second set of slides. At the bottom, it says change presentation.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so go ahead and take over the slides again.
How do I take over?
You click the slides tab.
Slides, okay.
And then it'll pop up that you're going to take over.
Okay, and then?
At the very bottom of the slide screen, there's a change presentation button.
Yeah, do you guys see slide one now?
Let me look. Yes, I do. Liberty Plan?
Yeah, Liberty Plan.
Here we go.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
So a Liberty Plan is a sort of customized planning tool that I created because a lot of the people that I support occasionally, the people that I support that have autism and have some maybe some support issues that require some more unique intervention, I guess. sitting through a path and a map or an essential lifestyle plan seemed to be a little bit cumbersome and a little bit, what I was told by a couple of people is maybe a little bit intrusive or a little bit invasive. A Liberty Plan is sort of like a path light. It's kind of like diet path sort of thinking. it's designed to help identify strengths and previous successes and to capture brainstorming moments. So it's a shorter meeting. It's much quicker in pace and designed so that the person can participate to a pretty high degree. So kind of the reason why I wanted to share the Liberty Plan was to make sure that it was clear that person-centered planning and customized supports and that sort of thing, there are a billion tools that can be used to do that. But person-centered planning isn't a tool. It's a theory, and it really needs to be a mindset. So whether you're using an actual tool that is, you know, professionally made tool or something that you went to training to learn how to do and you can facilitate it really well, it's not about that. customized supports and person-centered planning is a theme of, and a mindset or a culture, really, of how to support people. And whether you've learned how to do a specific tool or not, allow yourself to take the risk of doing person-centered planning. Really figure out how to listen to the person that you're supporting, your child, your student, whoever, and really get in there and figure out plans that you can commit to that you can help that person achieve. So I think that sometimes customized support and person-centered planning don't happen because people are afraid of the idea that you have to have specialized training. And the previous tools that I showed you, the PATH, the MAP, the Essential Lifestyle Plan, it's true that you do need to have some specific training. But what shouldn't happen is not doing personalized support systems and individualized planning just because you don't have that training. Circles of support are another type of person-centered planning. Circles of support are as basic as getting together with people that know that person really well and are committed to that person, have a vested interest in making sure that that person is happy and has a really good quality of life based on what they want. Circles of support are just basically regular meetings driven by the focus person to whatever degree that they can. They are, you know, action-driven. So they're not just cocktail parties or, you know, cake and ice cream. They're actually action-driven planning meetings that are driven by the person. So they're best if they are casual and, you know, for everybody. I think that's true for however most people perform, is that when things are more casual and less, quote-unquote, professional, people are able to get to the bottom line a little easier. It's less terrifying. And the function of the circle can be as flexible as the person wants it to be. They could meet monthly. They could meet weekly. They could meet at a coffee shop, you know, every quarter. It doesn't matter. There's no set guidelines. It's not like an IDT meeting, an interdisciplinary team meeting that has to meet every, you know, strategic 6 months or whatever. It's not something that is driven by the system. It's not driven by making sure that you meet those Medicaid waiver requirements. It's not about that. It's really about figuring out how to create customized quality supports for people. John O'Brien and Connie Lyle O'Brien have actually written quite a bit about the five valued experiences. If you think about your life and what makes your life the quality that you want it to be, it's no different for you than it would be for somebody with autism. It's, you know, people want valued experiences. They want to have community presence. They want to be in their community and be a valued part of that community. They want to have participation in the community. Participation really is maintained by relationships. So it's not just going to the grocery store. It's actually creating relationships with the butcher at the grocery store, whoever it is that makes sense for that person, the checker at the grocery store, the flower person at the grocery store. It's the relationships that make people's quality of lives better. It's not about getting them to a ball game. It's about the experience and the relationships that happen at the ball game. Valued roles and how people are seen in the community, what they what their reputations say about them, what people see what people see in them as valued gifts back to the community. When people can give back, by and large, when people give back, they feel better about themselves. I think that one of the key ingredients that we miss out on in supporting people with developmental disabilities is that one of the keys to life is reciprocity. That is about relationships, and that is about giving back to the community of our choosing, contributing to the environment around us. Oftentimes, especially for people who have been, you know, in the system for many, many years, reciprocity just isn't taught. And it's people lose sight of the fact that they need to give back. Relationships are only real, true, golden relationships if they're reciprocal. You give and you take, you give and you take. If you're constantly just taking, the relationship that ends up at the end product of that is not a healthy relationship. You could have a relationship with somebody if you only gave or you only took, but it's probably not a healthy relationship. There's probably some dysfunction in there somewhere. So real healthy relationships are only going to be when somebody learns how to give and take. And so when I see agencies or, you know, people have goals of creating friendships, but nowhere in there is the idea of teaching that person how to have reciprocated actions towards the person that they're interested in having a relationship with. So one of my goals is always to allow people the opportunities to figure out how to do reciprocity. It's really important. Promoting choice, allowing people to have true choice, not living the lives of what their parents want them to do. I want you for a second to think about what it was like when you were a teenager or a young adult. And if by any chance you remember what your parents' dreams were for you, I can remember my parents' dreams for me. And I'm comparing my life today to what my parents wanted for me. And the ideals are totally different, markedly different. It doesn't mean that I didn't meet some of the criteria that my parents wanted for me, but I went about it in a much different way. If I didn't have the flexibility and the autonomy to do what I wanted, my life would be totally different than it is. And so one of the things that I am grateful for is that I had the autonomy and the support to go ahead and do things my way. And I made a huge ton of mistakes. But some of my biggest learning was out of those mistakes. And I think sometimes we don't allow for that to happen. People aren't given the opportunity to make choices that then have consequences to those choices. There's mistakes made, and then the learning never happens because the mistakes aren't made. So I don't, of course, want to set people up to fail. That's not what I'm suggesting. But allowing people the opportunity to make mistakes on their own and supporting them through those mistakes on the other side. And supporting contributions with their unique gifts, figuring out what those gifts are and how they can use those competencies and those talents and desires to improve their community around them. some of the things to consider when doing person-centered planning, customizing supports, is to never do a plan first on somebody else without doing a plan on yourself. The reason is because doing person-centered planning and having your information out there in public can be very, very vulnerable and can be very intimidating. If you've never had that done on yourself, then as a facilitator of that plan, you have no idea what that feels like. If you don't know what that feels like, then you're not going to be a really connected facilitator of that plan. So it's really important to whatever degree that you can to have some sort of person-centered plan done on yourself around people who care about you and who you feel vulnerable in front of. whenever you're doing a plan, you need to focus on the person being supported and make sure that they understand that you're not going to put anything on the plan that they don't agree to. So you may be asking them if you can ask questions of the group around them, but you're not going to do that unless they say yes. So figuring out how that person communicates and to what degree that they want control over what goes up there and stuff is really important. You're going to want to match the plan to the situation. So like I went through the path and maps and essential lifestyle planning, liberty plan and stuff like that, you're going to want to match the plan to whatever situation comes up. That's why knowing how to do a variety of plans, and there's many more future plans than just the ones that I presented. There's dozens and dozens of them. They're all over the place. And you can create your own. But matching the plan to the situation is really important. facilitating a futures plan is an art form, and it takes a lot of practice and commitment. So it's also intimidating for the facilitators. So, you know, make sure people know that you're just a beginner or whatever. Invite people who have commitment to that focus person, understanding that you may invite 15 people and 3 people might show up. But you know what? Those are the right people that need to be there. And don't worry about it. Don't get caught up on, you know, grandma didn't show up or dad didn't show up or the teacher didn't show up or whatever. Don't get caught up on that. Whoever's there are the right people, and the plan can still take place. One of my favorites is bake it and they will come. I learned this from a friend of mine named Shafiq Asante. He was from the Philadelphia area. He passed away about 10 years ago or so, but he was a brilliant community builder, And he always said that if you have food, it reduces the anxiety level of the people that are in the room. And he used to work with gang members and really high anxiety situations and had tons of success with the bake it and they will come theory. And I have found through my learning that having food available is always a good thing. People aren't looking to, you know, leave the meeting so that they can go get their next or whatever. So it's really important to keep people comfortable. Casual is always better, Steffi. And I'm a super casual person. I'm a flip-flop and shorts kind of girl. But so maybe I might be saying this in order to back up the fact that I wear flip-flops to work every day. I don't know. But I think casual is always better than stuffy. People are just less likely to share personal thoughts in a meeting that doesn't make any sense to them and that there's a bunch of suits sitting around that don't know them than if you're, you know, hanging out on the floor eating, you know, Pringles and whatever. Casual is always a better way to go. Believing in the process is critical, and doing a plan just so that you can say you did a plan. This happens a lot in the funding systems, that they have regulations that they have to meet, and so doing a plan is one way that they go about meeting those needs and then crossing it off the list that they did their annual event. But that's not a waste of everybody's time. That's not that doesn't work very well, and it doesn't work for the person. It may meet their need, but that's not any way to go about doing that. Don't ever do a plan if you don't plan on helping that person follow through with the plan. Allowing somebody to dream something and put it out there to people and really get their dreams out in a vision, and then putting it up on a shelf and not attending to it, is probably one of the cruelest things that you could do to somebody. Imagine being heard for the first time and people acknowledging that you had some dreams and some ideals about your life and then nobody working on it. That would be worse than never having the opportunity to dream, I think. So don't do it if you don't plan on following through with it. The common things that come up in person-centered planning that are confusing for people is that the person at the center of the plan is the authority of the direction of the plan. So it should not happen unless that person actually wants a plan being done. It's not something that other people decide whether or not it's going to happen. It needs to be done with the consent and the complete involvement of the person that the plan is about. And the purpose of person-centered planning is learning through shared action. It's about walking together with people. It's about collaboration. It's about partnering and allyship. It's not about a log or a document. It's about gathering together and everybody getting on the same page. So you can't move in unison towards the same goal if not everybody's on the same page. So it's about learning through shared action. It's about stimulating hospitality. You can't be immersed in person-centered planning and keep people segregated at the same time. They're not compatible. They don't collude like that. So if you're doing true person-centered planning, the only option is integration, inclusion, full participation. There's no way to do it any other way. So you know that if the person that you're planning for is still segregated, then the plan has not come to full fruition. If true person-centered planning is accomplished, then the customized supports will just ooze from that. The customized supports will drip off of the plan. Once you figure out where you need to go, the customized supports will come out of that. The other thing is that person-centered planning and customized supports, it's not for the faint of heart. So if you're a little woozy and a little uncertain about how to support somebody, you might want to take heed before you do person-centered planning. It really tests your stance and your ethical standards and your values. You will absolutely have emotional and visceral reactions to some things that happen. I've had a lot of very interesting experiences through person-centered planning that I did not anticipate that have happened, and it's really tested where I stand on certain themes. So I want to share a couple of experiences with you. This is a gentleman named Alan. He grew up in a group home since he was about 6 years old. He was never successful in the group home because of his individual support needs. He has autism, and he has the following challenges. He has pica, really irregular sleeping patterns, like sleeps maybe 3 hours a day, and then cat naps during the day in 15, 20-minute increments. Really significant food allergies, a seizure disorder, no real solid means of communication, extremely loud noises that other people have said are obnoxious and disturbing and interrupting and that kind of thing. A history of running away daily, and several times daily usually. So they call it AWOL behavior or whatever. And he's assaultive occasionally when tasks are presented to him. So we did some person-centered planning for Alan. I spent a lot of time with Alan and his team and tried to figure out, so this is the guy, what are we going to do to be successful with him? He's one of those guys, he's very, very hyper, very active. He's just kind of stimulated all the time. We could try to contain him, and I'm sure that wouldn't improve his quality of life. So we got together people who cared about him. And there was a couple people who didn't like him very much, actually, in that group, but I didn't know it at the time. So we came up with some adaptations that would allow Alan to have a better life. He has a wake staffing arrangement all the time. So previous to that, he was in a group home where the staff were able to sleep at night. And, of course, when he would wake up, they considered that to be disruptive. So now the staff are awake all the time, and it's not disruptive because they're awake anyway. He lives in a home out in the country with miles before a major road where he can just run as much as he wants to. He lives alone. He has alarms on his doors to alert the team members when he leaves his home. So they're not alarms to keep him in. They're alarms just to, like, if they're in the laundry room or something like that, they're in the bathroom, the alarm goes off. They know that Alan has left the house. So the intention is that Alan's team follows him, and they go running with him. They're working on the best means of communication. It still is a very, very slow process, but they're exploring different methods. he's currently using a letter board and looking forward to his first iPad, which he doesn't have yet, but it's in the works. His whole team are people who love to run, love to be active. When he moved into his new home, they took out all of the plants around the entire house, and the landlord helped them with this, and they put in a huge herb garden. So the things that are in his garden now are mint and parsley and licorice and stonecrop, whatever that is, great plants, onions, and dandelions. And so he's able to eat his garden because his pica before was he would eat things that were not healthy for him. He would get sick, really sick. So now he's able to go out in his yard run around and eat the stuff that's out there, and he doesn't get sick, and he loves it. And he's actually much, much healthier than he was. They replaced his windows in his home with plexiglass because he would break the windows just to hear them crash. And now he doesn't do that anymore because they don't break, and so he's not getting the visceral response to that. And now he's working for the U.S. Department of Forestry planting trees. and he happens to be in a department where they're planting some sort of shrub that's edible. So he eats part of the plant while he's working, but it's not an issue anymore. I can't remember what it is that he's eating, but it's a plant that's used to stave off fires. It's a very succulent plant, and it's good for him. So he's happy. He works probably 10 hours a week. He looks forward to going to work. He's excited about it. And he works with part-time. Part of that work is also done with a CCC crew, which is people that are younger than him. And he's kind of a mentor to these younger kids. They're all below the age of, I think, 25 or something like that. And so they see him as a mentor. So he's also doing some community activism where he's teaching these young kids about autism, and he loves it. So that's Alan. Oh, wow. The O at the top of the page is unusual. It cut off his name, but this is Carlo. Carlo lived in an ICF facility in Northern California in his teens and his 20s, and I think the early 30s also. Carlo and his team had a horrible time budgeting and getting and keeping Carlo employed. Carlo is a self-described lazy man, and he's a spendaholic. He knows that he's lazy. I'm not outing him right now. He describes himself as lazy. He hates to work. He is just somebody who just isn't interested or hasn't found anything that he's interested in working yet. Carlo also has autism. He doesn't communicate in traditional means. He, as you can see, is a very handsome man. And again, he's lazy. Really seriously lazy. So it was really hard because he is a spendaholic. He spends money like it's water. And we've been trying to figure out ways to allow Carlo to have control over his money, but he doesn't have very much money because he doesn't work, so he's on Social Security income only, and loves to spend it, but he's an adult, so we can't really, he doesn't have a conservator, can't really keep his money from him. So it's a huge quandary. This is one of those areas where my values come into play because my inner self was telling me to control his money, and my person-centered self was saying this is Carlo's decision and he needs to have some consequences and figure this out. So over a long period of time, we tried to figure out how we could get Carlo engaged in employment that he liked, that he would be motivated about. And it just wasn't, it was just really challenging. So as you can see in the picture, he's an extremely handsome man in his 20s. He was like a chiseled Greek god, just very, very attractive. He loves being naked, very much enjoys being naked, predominantly naked most of the time if he had his way. He lives in a university town. He prefers to not work at all, but if he's going to work, it needs to be in very, very short increments, and by that I mean like 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Now it's up to maybe half an hour, but he's real active, too. He doesn't use traditional language, so a job where he needs to speak is not going to work. He's also very loud, so he needs to be in a place where he can be loud if he wants to be. Any ideas what his job might be?
Tell me he's not a stripper.
Well, he's not a stripper. But you're getting very warm. He is a still nude model in the art department at a university in Northern California. So he models for the art department and gets paid to do it. And so he does still nude modeling about 9 days a semester and gets paid fairly well, I mean, for an hour or two of work. And he asks for it now, where he loves having that money and knows that, you know, He understands. He would be naked 24/7 if he had the opportunity. But you know, there's not a lot of jobs for him that work. And when he was asked by a team member who was in the art department if that would be something he'd be interested in, he listened very intently. And when they told him about what kind of contract he would have, he listened very intently, and everybody thought, oh, he's not going to understand what this really means. But Carlo did understand and does very well. He's actually getting a bit older and isn't quite the chiseled god that he was before, and so he's looking for new employment. But this has worked for a very long time, and he might be nearing time. I don't have very much contact with him anymore because I moved, but he might be nearing retirement age now, but that was a very successful job for him for a long time, and it didn't require him to be anybody that he wasn't. It, you know, that's a job that made perfect sense to him. This is a gal that I currently support. Jamie was denied customized services in California because of a variety of reasons, mostly because she has autism, which, you know, we were like, and so what's wrong with that? Her reputation that preceded her when I first got her collateral packet was that she was too dangerous. And she looks pretty dangerous. I mean, that picture, she looks fairly scary. It would take too many specialized, trained people to support her. She needs too many staff for her to be successful. So they were saying that she needed a 2-to-1 ratio and that she just, it just wasn't possible financially. They couldn't afford it. And that nobody was listening to Jamie's dreams, that her dreams were really unrealistic, and that everybody thought that her dreams were really outside the realm of being typical, and why would she want these things? And so we took a look at Jamie's dreams, and her dreams were to go to college. That's pretty normal. Live in a house of her home, of her own, an apartment or a home. Okay, that was my dream too when I was her age. Have a cat. Have a job that makes a difference. Work with animals, hang with her friends, get married. So I think what freaked everybody out was the get married part. Everything else was just like, oh, well, you know, there's no way she's going to get married. There's no way she's going to go to college. There's no way she's going to be able to live in her own home. When we started doing planning with Jamie, I couldn't figure out what the part was about her being really dangerous and needing so much support. It just seemed like once you listened to Jamie and told her, you know, the circumstances of her dream and what could make that happen, she seemed pretty straightforward and that, you know, some adaptations needed to happen, but it wasn't out of the realm of possibilities. So we created some adaptations for her that allowed her to reduce her anxiety and her need for 24/7 support. She's another person who's really, really hard to budget for. And so what was happening with all the budget plans that we had for her was that she's a person who needed to see what she had. And so we created a envelope system where she could see literally how much money she had per week. It was put into categories within the envelope system. And then once that money in that category was gone, then it was gone until the next week when she went back to the bank. And so once we created the envelope system, she's been on budget ever since. She's never gone over. She would have a lot of anxiety over who was working with her or what her schedule was for the day. So something as simple as just writing down her staffing schedule so she could read it. Nobody had ever done that before, and she was 24 at the time. That just seemed very bizarre to me. Jamie's somebody who does not do well with downtime. She needs to have something kind of scheduled for her, or at least an option to be scheduled for her all the time. And she can choose to do it or not, but if it's scheduled for her, she knows she has an activity to participate in. She needs intentional, long preparation periods. It takes her, she's on Jamie time, and if you're anticipating that you need to rush her for any reason, that's just absolutely not going to work. So she needs a long time to prepare for things. She needs a lot of information, and she needs just a transition time that is probably at least twice, if not three times longer than other people. So So, okay, we gave her intentional long periods of preparation. And in the beginning, she needed 24-hour support for safety because she didn't understand. She didn't have very good safety skills, so she just needed to be taught that. So we've been working on that for about 3 years. She needs a healthy diet. She eats a macrobiotic diet, and she knows that for her, if she doesn't eat healthy, her mood and her behavior are really affected negatively. So she eats really healthy, takes vitamins, sees an acupuncturist, all that kind of stuff. Honor Jamie's priority. She needed to know that she was being heard and that what she said mattered. She also needed to have regular team meetings with her entire team in the room at the same time so that she would know for sure that they were listening to her. So she's had tons of success in the last 3 years, and we've been supporting her for about 3.5 years, I guess. So she works 2 different jobs. She now works for the school system as a paid kind of an office aide, and she started out with one-to-one job coaching, and now she has 100% generic support in the office that she works in, so she doesn't have anybody go with her to work at all. She has about, that's actually out of date, the 8 to 10 hours of alone time per week is that she probably gets much more than that, more like 20, where she's alone. Prior to that, she had somebody with her every waking moment, every sleeping moment, every moment of the day, she had somebody with her. She's making many more decisions with less and less help, and she consults her team instead of depending on her team, so she asks them for advice instead of waiting for them to do it for her. She's much more responsible for life decisions like budgeting and cleaning, and she's understanding consequences of those actions much more regularly. She handles relationship issues with other people much more maturely, and she's doing reciprocity on an active level. She has her cat, Emily, living with her. She's working on having an adult parent-child relationship with her mom and dad, where prior to that, her mom and dad, which I'm sure many of you can understand, were seen as the case manager and the therapist and the nurse and the staff person. Oftentimes the parents are put into roles that other people can't even imagine, that they're not able to have a regular adult-child relationship because that's never what they've lived through. So she's working on creating that relationship with her mom and dad, and it's going really well. And Jamie's life has changed in the last 2 years, 3 years dramatically. Her main goal when she started hanging out with us was that she wanted to have a relationship. She wanted to get married. And so she got married to her soulmate. One of the pictures is missing, but she got married to her soulmate, Tim, in November of 2010, just this last year. Tim's a gentleman that we also support, and they are the most amazing couple on the planet, pretty much, as far as I can tell. So she actually met her dream when they met. Tim's dream was also to get married, and a lot of the same things that she wanted were the same things that Tim wanted. And I actually set them up. I'm not bragging or anything, but I am actually a really good, wedding planner. Another kind of support that we provide. Just kidding. So, I mean, basically what the thing is about person-centered planning and customized supports is that all of the ingredients need to be available. You need to have opportunity for interactions. You need to have confidence. You need to have exposure. The more exposure you have, the more confidence you have, the more opportunities you have. And it's just a vicious cycle. If all three of those are not present, then the success in living a customized life or the life of your very own is going to be less successful. So we believe in creating opportunities that allow for people to express themselves in a way that they may not have been able to do that before. So that basically is it. I have some references here, people who I've learned a great deal from that I would be remiss if I did not include them, but references to Inclusion Press and The Grove, Capacity Works, and the ELPNet and Learning Community, all incredibly valuable places to learn from if you're interested in that. So I don't know if there's questions out there or...
Okay.
If you're calling on the phone, you can raise your hand to ask Beth a question by pressing star 2, and I will see your hand raised, and I will connect the two of you together. In the meantime, I'll go to the questions that have been coming in through the website.
Okay.
Carol from Houston asks, she said there are dozens of future plans out there. What is it called if we want to Google it?
I would probably Google person-centered planning or personal futures plan and see what comes up. I'm not sure that I've ever actually done that, but that would be where I would start. You might also want to, depending on if you're talking about a child in school or an adult, school plans, school future plans, you know, play around with those kind of words and see what comes up with that.
Okay. And I was curious, who summoned you to help these individuals?
I'm sorry, who
was it? Their family? Was it the group home?
Oh, with the individuals that I presented about or anybody?
Yes. Yes, that you worked with, that you presented about.
Alan is a guy that I was consulting with, a group home company that is in Northern California. I was consulting with them, and I had known Alan for years and years and years. And then so they were having some problems and wanted to bring me in to see if we could switch things around. Carlo is a guy that I was connected with the agency during a presentation that I had done, and after the presentation they asked me to do some consulting for him. And Jamie is a person that I support through my agency currently, Jamie and Tim both. And they were referred to me by, in California, it's the Regional Center System, which is the Department of Developmental Services. So they've referred her to my agency for support.
Is LifeWorks a place where individuals with disabilities can go to, or are you consulting? Do you go to them?
We both, in a nutshell, but LifeWorks provides customized supports to people. So we have people that we do case management for. So we do all supported living, independent living, customized employment, micro-enterprise, that kind of stuff. So all of the supports that we provide to people who are on a regular basis referred to us and we have contracts with, those are all customized support situations, one-on-one. And then we also do consulting to agencies and families and school districts and stuff like that. So both, but LifeWorks is generally a support agency. You come to us for ongoing support.
Are you separate from the developmental disabilities for the state or the county?
No, we're funded through the state, through the regional center system, through the Department of Developmental Services.
Okay.
We also do some private pay funding, but 99.9% of our revenue is from the Department of Developmental Services.
Okay. All right, I'm starting to see the little spider web now. I get it. We had a question come in from Melody in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
Melody says, I'm a 15-year-old with a high-functioning Aspie sister and
mm-hmm.
a high-functioning Aspie father, and my brother is also extremely high-functioning. How do I find good support?
And where are you from again?
She's from Louisiana.
Louisiana. I am not familiar with what occurs in Louisiana around support systems, but I would look under the Department of Health Services or Human Services, and generally that will lead you to whatever it is that the system is in Louisiana that supports people that provides supports for people individualized like that. I'm not familiar with the Louisiana system. I'm sorry, I can't, because they're all called something different. Department of Health and Human Hygiene or Department of Mental Health or, you know, Department of Social Services. I'm not exactly sure what Louisiana calls it. But also your doctor should be able to refer you to the system, and, you know, then you can check people out. I think anytime you're looking for supports that you need to interview an agency, to find out if it's a good match, because, you know, as the way that LifeWorks looks at it anyway, is that when we're committing to somebody, we're committing to that person for life, and it's almost like we're getting married. You know, I'm not going away from you, even if things get ugly. So we need to be able to make sure that we are that we have the same philosophy and we can work together. So I think it's important that you interview whoever it is that's going to be supporting you in whatever way. I wish I had better information about how to find those people, but I hope that helped a little bit.
Yeah, I think it probably pointed her in the right direction. I'm going to generalize this question from Elizabeth in San Lorenzo. If you have somebody on the person-centered planning team who really isn't supporting the plan,
mm-hmm.
how can you deal with that? Say it's a parent.
I've been there many times. So one of the ways that I try to nip that in the bud is from the very first second that I'm with those people, whether it's from the invitation or the very first minute that we're together in a room, I make it really clear that I'm not here for the parent. I'm not doing the parent's plan. I'm doing the individual's plan. And they might be really different from each other. And but my job isn't to support the parent at this point. My job is to draw out the information from the person and figure out how we can all get on board. Now, if the parent can't get on board, then sometimes they're asked to leave or they're asked to not participate. That's really hard, obviously, for a lot of really obvious reasons. But I think nipping that in the bud from the very first second, like when I'm creating the invitation list, I'm, for the most part, not going to the parent for that invitation list. Because the parent probably has ideas about who they want to come, but that may not be the idea of who the person wants to come. So it's really important that that boundary be set right away. And sometimes it can get kind of hectic because the parent is usually the person that has a lot of say-so in what's going on in that person's life. So I think the very best way about it, that any literature that you give that person, any discussions that you have with that person, it's always, 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 100% of the time, the person's plan. And they're invited to it as though they were an equal participant as everybody else that's being invited to it. They have no more power and no more say-so than anybody else. The person drives the plan, and if they aren't on board, then they cannot participate. That's fine, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and suppose you have an individual who doesn't express desires, dreams, wishes. Is it still helpful to create a person-centered plan?
Oh, yeah. Even more so, probably. Even more so. I think that person is probably the person that hasn't been heard the most, usually. And so, you know, it's obviously more challenging, for sure, to do planning with somebody who doesn't express themselves in the typical way. My experience is that if you're really listening to people, even if they're not speaking, if you're really listening to people and they really get that you're planning for their future, that they will participate in some way that sometimes will blow your mind. But if somebody's not participating and isn't expressing any dreams or any desires or whatever, then maybe they're not ready for a plan. That's true, too. But it doesn't always mean that. Sometimes I think we misread that as being not ready for a plan, and what it really means is I don't know how to say what I'm trying to say. And so it just takes more time. And it's kind of like if I was trying to do a plan for somebody who speaks Hebrew and I don't speak Hebrew and they don't speak English, I'm not going to expect them to learn English. I'm going to try to figure out how to understand his language, whether it's through an interpreter or whatever. So I need to figure out what it is that they're saying, whether it's through sounds or typing or body language or whatever it is. That's my role, to figure out how to do that. So, you know, I'm sure you've all heard that not being able to speak is not the same as not having anything to say. It's kind of the same premise. Our role is just made more complicated, but doesn't mean stop. It just means, again, figuring out what the next best question is and how to get that information.
Okay. What is the youngest and oldest individuals that you've helped create a person-centered plan for?
Well, I've done plans for preschoolers. I've done plans for families who were pregnant, so I guess that's probably the youngest. And the oldest, a couple of years ago, I helped a person with autism who was in her 70s who was dying, and her plan was about how to figure out how to do her support the best to make her, she had cancer,
mm-hmm.
and so how to figure out how to make the end of her life the best she could make it. So I think she was like 74-ish, something like that.
We have a caller that would like to ask you a question. Let me unmute them. It takes just a second for them to connect.
Okay.
Hi, caller. Did you have a question for Beth?
Yes. I have a son who was 6.
Mm-hmm.
And we did soccer last fall, and he didn't like it. He really improved over it.
Mm-hmm.
And now spring baseball is coming. He doesn't like to go to school, but we still go to school. He just likes to stay at home. Where do I draw the line between what is good for him and what he needs to do and what we need to do to open his world? Because we've really kind of pushed the envelope on opening his world, and he's made phenomenal progress. So how much of that do we keep doing, and where do we, you know, baseball's too much, we're not going to do it?
Well, I think it's all about those opportunities and the engagement. I think that sometimes where we get stuck is that the individuals that we're around show some resistance, and so it gets easier to just avoid creating the opportunities. So I'm a big proponent of, you know, I wouldn't necessarily force anybody to go do something, but constantly creating opportunities where socialization and activities that he might become really excited about are created. Without knowing your son, I don't know how far you would push him, but I wouldn't give up. It sounds like, maybe there's some reasons why staying at home and that kind of thing seems like a better choice for him. Maybe it's just more comfortable, and maybe it's just a place where he can chill out and relax. And, you know, maybe he's 6, so maybe he just hasn't learned the skills that allow him to be comfortable in the community yet. So creating those opportunities where he can have little mini successes over and over is just going to make it much easier for him to be successful in the future. But I wouldn't give up on that kind of stuff. Grow on whether it was soccer or baseball or whatever, figure out what one little thing that he really loves to do, and then grow that, you know, figure out. Sometimes what I do with people is just do a think tank. If somebody likes, skateboarding, what kind of things can you do around skateboarding that would allow him to have more opportunities? So it's not just skateboarding in his driveway. You could go to the skate park. You could take him to, you know, the boardwalk and skateboard. You could go to, you know, skateboarding shops, and, you know, so just figure out what ideas it is that he really likes and grow those ideas.
Thank you, Paula.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm sitting here wondering how you do person-centered planning on a fetus.
Well, it was the family's plan, but they knew that their baby had Down syndrome, and so they were trying to plan for the future. So that was kind of sarcastic, but it is true. I did do the plan for the family who were, I think, maybe eight months pregnant with a little baby boy. So they
really
just
planning
they
ahead.
Thoughts, and it really helped.
Yeah.
It helped them to kind of get focused and get started.
It was interesting.
Same. I learned a lot.
Sandra from Honolulu asks, Do clients need to be California residents to take advantage of your services? And if so, is there a national association where they could find planners like you in other states?
Good question. As far as as far as the services that we provide for people living in their own homes and that kind of thing, currently we're vendorized with the state of California, but we do have some private pay people. So if people want to live in San Diego, I mean, I'll come to Honolulu if you want me to. I mean, that would be horrible. But we do private pay, and as far as planning services, there's people that do person-centered planning all over the United States, all over the world, really. And there's different places that you can find those people, and I'm trying to think. Michael Small, I think, has a list on the Learning Community website. I think it's learningcommunity.com. And then Inclusion Press also has a list of people who do some stuff on there, and that's on inclusion.com. So it depends on what you're talking about. If you're talking about direct support services, then we do those in San Diego County only at this point. But if you're talking about person-centered planning, we do that all over the place. So if I understood your question correctly.
Yeah, I think so. And you had mentioned before that you do private pay. Is it is it cost prohibitive? Is it ballpark?
We charge the same as what the state charges. It's just there's certain people that don't qualify for services. Mm-hmm. For instance, people who don't qualify for regional center services, which is services for people with developmental disabilities, they may have mental health issues, or they may slip through the cracks. For some reason, they don't qualify for one or the other. We also have looked into providing services for people with disabilities that maybe are veterans of the war or have disabilities that occurred after the age of 18 that don't qualify for some certain services that currently pay us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's different situations where the private pay would come into place. But as far as the person-centered planning, that's just a consultation service that we have that is not paid for by the state.
Okay. You understand PATH a lot better than I do, so this question will probably make sense to you.
Okay.
Carol from Houston asks, "Hi, my child is elementary-aged with the PATH map. Mm-hmm. Could she, meaning you, explain the columns of now, and what does stronger mean?"
Ah, okay. I do understand that. So on a path, after the goals and the dreams are created, and the strong visual image is kind of put up on paper and figured out what that person wants, the next step is to spend a little time figuring out what is going on now for that person. And the intention behind doing the now is to create the drama effect or the dichotomy between where that person is now and where they really want to be. So it's kind of creates tension and creates a motivation to get where they want to go. So that's what the now is about. We generally don't spend a lot of time in the now because it really is supposed to be just a snapshot of my life now looks like this versus in 3 years I really want to be here. And so creating that tension between the two. The stronger category is the next category, or the two categories over, actually. And stronger is about identifying the things, the actions, the whatever it is that's going to help that team of people leading that person to that dream. What is going to keep those people motivated and driven to get there? Because I'm sure everybody has been in a situation where they've come up with an idea or a plan, and then as soon as the meeting is over, everything's folded up and put away, and then nobody addresses that again until the next meeting when it's like, so what did we get accomplished? And they're all, oh, yeah, I totally forgot to make those phone calls, or, oh, I forgot to write that paper, or I forgot to connect with so-and-so. The stronger part is what's going to keep your motivation on fire, what's going to keep keep you going and keep you going in the right direction and not stop. Because, again, the worst thing that you could do is allow somebody to dream and then not give them the opportunities to address that dream or to follow that dream. So stronger is about keeping you on task.
Speaking of being on task, it's time for us to wrap things up here. But
okay.
Beth, I wanted to thank you so much for participating with us today. And is there a way that folks can contact you directly if they have questions?
Yeah, I have a website, and all of my contact information is on the website. So my website is www.lifeworks-sls, S as in Sam, LarrySam.com.
Okay, thank you for sharing that with us. I'm
absolutely.
Sure you're getting a lot of emails, mine included.
Oh, good.
Thank you very much. I want to let our participants know that if you want a transcript of this event, please join our Spectrum Gold Club. We'll send you a copy of the webinar audio and transcript, plus 29 other webinars when you join.
Awesome.
Also, tell us what you think.